tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Ameri, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. We would like to welcome Dr. Christiana Bratiotis on Research Review today. Dr. Bratiotis is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at UBC and a faculty chair for the Master of Social Work program. Hi, it's great to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself and what got you interested in social work?
Sure. So I've been an associate professor at UBC. I'll be starting my sixth year next fall. And I come from the United States, where I was born and went to school and also started faculty life. I earned my MSW at the University of Nevada, Reno. That is my master's in social work. And my doctorate in social work from Boston University, which is where I also did a three-year postdoctoral research fellowship. And, you know, social work really found me. I was raised by parents who were, by their nature and profession, helpers. And I think it was modeled for me from an early life. And then I had an opportunity to develop and direct a mentoring program in a high school after I finished my bachelor's degree. And it was really between my bachelor's and master's degree and that year of work that I realized that that social work was where I wanted to be. And I happened to meet a PhD in social work, Dr. Susan Chandler, who was my inspiration to pursue an MSW. And lucky for me, we're still friends to today.
Great, yeah. I know your particular field of social work now focuses on hoarding and hoarding disorders, so maybe it'd be good to define that for the audience before we delve into it.
Yeah, you bet. So I started researching hoarding during my own doctoral studies while at Boston University, and that was in 2004, and I've been working in the field exclusively since then. Hoarding is, it really has a definition that was first put forward in the late 1990s, and it is the definition that persists to today. It's also the definition that led to the diagnostic or mental health criteria for diagnosis of hoarding disorder. And the three parts of the definition are that the spaces in the home are cluttered to the point where they can't be used for the intended purpose. So perhaps someone can't sleep in their bed, perhaps they can't prepare a meal in their kitchen, all because of the amassed amount of stuff. And people with lived experience of hoarding hold on to those objects because they find great value in them. It is typically those of us who are trying to help family members or friends or professionals, or those that are troubled by the problem, perhaps family or friends or neighbors, that find the objects in a hoarded home to be useless or of limited value. So that's the exact opposite perspective of the person who is doing the hoarding of the objects. And the third part of that definition is that there is emotional distress or interference in carrying out daily life activities that's caused by the hoarding. And hoarding, really, just to be clear, is about volume of possessions or the amount, quantity of stuff in a home. And I think that concept has gotten a little confused by the television shows, because they also show the concept of squalor alongside hoarding.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like a step above maybe a college student who's too lazy to clean their dorm room.
That's right. Though we know that the problem of hoarding onsets actually in childhood and early adolescence. Over 50% of cases of hoarding, according to one research study, onsets between ages 11 and 20 years old. So college-age students are kind of right in that age where the problem may be developing, but it also is true that it is not a problem that really worsens until several decades later.
Yeah. When it comes to the work you do personally, is it more on the psychological side of hoarding or the social support side?
Yeah, great question. So I actually am trained as a cognitive behavioral therapist, and I have provided clinical treatment using cognitive behavioral therapy for individuals with lived experience of hoarding, both individually and in group settings, and I've worked with family members in that way. But my research as a scholar is really focused on the sort of place where this private mental health problem intersects with public health and safety problems. And so I'm very interested in how different disciplines and sectors of a community come together to address hoarding when it's crossed that line from a private to a social or public problem.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
Tune in every Thursday from 11 p.m. till midnight for Copy and Paste with your host, Tim, a.k.a. Autonomy, the very best in underground dance music.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Christiana Bratiotis. Dr. Bratiotis is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at UBC and faculty chair for the Master of Social Work program. And today, in the past bit, we've just been talking a bit about her research into the issue of hoarding. So going along, Gurman, did you have anything to ask?
Okay, that's great. So could you maybe walk me through the process of assessing and handling a hoarding case?
Sure. It depends quite a lot, actually, on who is getting the referral and doing the initial assessment and planning the intervention. But in some communities, my research has revealed that In some communities, there are task forces or networks or coalitions, groups that come together, and these are cross-disciplinary groups. So you might have somebody from housing, somebody from mental health, somebody from nursing, veterinary, pest control, anyone who might become involved in the problem of hoarding around a table. And they actually talk about the referrals that come in to a line, for example, like 311 in the city of Vancouver, and talking about how did we get this referral? What are the areas of concern? Who needs to become involved? And these coalitions actually then decide who best goes out to assess the home. And if there is a fire risk, it might be a firefighter that goes. If there is a health risk to the person, it might be a public health nurse that goes. Of course, all of these disciplines also encounter hoarding as a matter of their daily work. So someone who is in housing, for example, a housing inspector may, or a city inspector may encounter hoarding just as part of their regular living unit inspections. Or a fire official might become aware of a hoarding unit and need to go there just based in their fire role. But these coalitions also are another mechanism by which cases come to attention. And then individuals go in, they use a variety of assessment tools, including an interview or conversation, as well as standardized assessments to judge the level of environmental risk and the risk to the person and their health and well-being.
Yeah. How does it particularly work in Vancouver? Is there like, you mentioned like hoarding response teams. Does Vancouver have one of those?
We did for a very long time, called HART, Hoarding Action Response Team. And it was a partnership of Vancouver Fire and Rescue Services, Vancouver Coastal Health, and for a while, the city's, in addition to the city's fire department, also property use was involved. That team is no longer, but Vancouver Fire and Rescue Services are still responding to to calls to the city line with concerns. And that team was really quite remarkable in that it combined a psychiatric nurse with a fire official who went into the homes, did the assessments, and helped plan and broker the interventions.
Yeah, is there a specific reason Heart is No More?
You know, I think like many interventions for hoarding, all of these require personnel. They require a line item on a budget. And if they exist long enough, the actual efforts get institutionalized in other systems and in other ways. And the team itself doesn't necessarily need to exist in the same way because there are other mechanisms already in place as a result of that team having been there for a number of years.
Okay, so you haven't really seen maybe a decrease in the quality of care provided since Heart has been disbanded?
You know, I can't say. Right. We certainly were involved from a research perspective with the Heart team for a good number of years. But I don't have access to information that would allow me to comment on that specifically. But I do know in other communities around North America where there have been these kind of response teams, the response becomes more institutionalized in other organizations. And things keep going as they were. It's just the team itself is not the response mechanism anymore.
Right. And going on to more the cleanup side, what sort of people do you have involved there?
Yeah, so cleanups for hoarding are, or cleanouts are a very interesting and somewhat controversial topic that we actually really know quite little about. And very, very excitingly, a doctoral student, Kate Kaiso, who is a UBC student affiliated with the Center for Collaborative Research on Hoarding, is pursuing a doctoral studies looking specifically at cleanouts for hoarding, because we don't actually have any good scientific evidence about the effectiveness of these interventions. It's often said that clinically these interventions can be another experience of loss or loss of control, or can be quite traumatic for the person experiencing them. But that's really anecdotal information. And we also don't have good information about how these things work, how they're organized, who's involved, how much they cost. And so Kate's work is really aimed at giving us the first in all of the world information, systematically collected information about cleanouts. So we should know much more about them quite soon.
Yeah, that's awesome. What would be the alternative to a clean out then? Would it just be having the patient themselves clean out their house over time?
That's right. So it's I think of it as a supported step-by-step reduction of the clutter or overall volume of things in the home. And there are a number of mechanisms that can be used to achieve that. So one, a person, if they're motivated and have access and resources, may choose cognitive behavioral therapy as a way to intervene and slowly reduce the overall volume of clutter through mental health treatment. But there are also other strategies like harm reduction for hoarding implemented by community-based organizations. This is not mental health treatment, but taking the principles that we know of harm reduction for things like substance use, for example, we apply them to hoarding, and the same goal is really driving the intervention, and that is that we reduce the risk for potential harm to the person without necessarily stopping all of the acquiring and saving that goes on with hoarding. So we might reduce the amount that comes in, and we might work with the person to save their items in different locations in their home. So if they're currently saving them in the oven and on the stove where things are highly combustible and we might have fire, we might just say, let's move these out of the oven and off the stove to an area across the room where we don't have the same fire risk. So it's not that we don't have the volume of objects in the home, we're just moving them out of high risk areas. And then slowly we might start to reduce the volume. So that's a step-by-step intervention for hoarding. And these can be carried out by just about anyone that encounters a person with lived experience of hoarding in the community. They can also be, in certain circumstances, carried out by family members, by friends. There's a whole host of folks who can help at that level of intervention.
Yeah, but from what I understand, from what how you're talking, it seems like there's a lot of resources required to handle a hoarding disorder, and maybe people don't necessarily have access to those sorts of resources. From what I've read, like 7% of single room occupancies on the downtown east side have excessive clutter. And I would imagine like SROs on the downtown east side usually are filled with people who don't necessarily have the access to the most resources. The single room occupancies, they don't usually have friends or family around that can help with those sorts of situations. So what sort of options do they have?
Yeah, you bet. That that statistic comes from the Carnegie Report, which was put out a number of years ago now. But you're right, there is a significant hoarding and clutter problem in the downtown east side. And sometimes the hoarding behavior is a behavior all by itself. Sometimes the behavior is secondary to other mental illnesses like psychosis and schizophrenia. We know that from research. And even other times, sometimes the hoarding is secondary to substance use disorders, for example. And I will say that there have been a number of efforts over the years in the downtown east side specifically related to hoarding. There have been some groups, some self-help groups called Buried in Treasures offered in the downtown east side. There also are housing organizations that are really deeply committed to this. We are, as a research center, in partnership with Lookout Housing and Health, which is a big provider of SRO housing in the downtown east side. They have a clutter reduction team within Lookout. They have tenant support workers whose job it is to specifically go in and support and help clients at risk of eviction from their SROs to address their clutter problem. They've been very fortunate to get some funds to support this program and the allocation of support workers. So I think increasingly, as this is becoming a problem that we're paying more and more attention to, there are increasing intervention efforts and also the allocation of resources specifically to hoarding problems. And I would say that you're also right that what we see as interventions in the downtown east side in SROs, for example, look very different than someone who might raise their hand voluntarily, have the ability to pay for cognitive behavioral therapy and seek out a private practitioner for that. But because hoarding is on a continuum, it's a behavior. And like any behavior, it exists from very mild to severe and life-taking. Our interventions also need to exist on a continuum because not everybody who has a hoarding problem needs the same kind of intervention. And so we want to be thoughtful about matching, doing good assessment and matching the intervention to not only the resources, but the level of risk that exists for that person.
Yeah. Do you know why? You mentioned that there was hoarding disorder is sometimes secondary to substance use disorder, but is there maybe any other reason why there is such a disproportionate number of hoarding cases found on the downtown east side in particular?
You know, we don't have scientific evidence for this, but certainly in our partnerships, in our research partnerships with some of the providers in the downtown east side and the city of Vancouver, who also provides housing in the downtown east side and intervention services, we've learned that, of course, the population also of people who live in that community also often have significant co-occurring mental illnesses, and we know that we can see hoarding alongside other mental illnesses. But we also know that experiences of life loss, significant life losses, are one of the vulnerabilities for developing a hoarding problem. And I just would want to clarify that it's not causal. It doesn't cause hoarding, but it's a vulnerability, like many other vulnerabilities for developing a behavior. And so that may be contributing. We know that folks in the downtown East Side often gather things up and save them with the idea of reselling them. And so sometimes rooms get very full of stuff that they have the intention of reselling as well. So there's many complex contributing factors for sure.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirod, and along with my co-host Germán, today we're interviewing Dr. Christiana Bratiotis, an associate professor in the School of Social Work at UBC. During this interview, we've been talking mostly about the issue of hoarding, and in the past, but we've talked about how hoarding is diagnosed and what are some potential interventions for dealing with hoarding. So, Germán, I think you had a question to ask.
Yeah. Do you know how maybe hoarding disorders are handled in other countries? Is there any like comparison done currently?
It's a very good question. We know some about hoarding behaviors and disorders in other countries in the global north. We don't know much about interventions in the global south, and that's in large measure because no one is systematically studying them. We don't have research colleagues there, but in the global north, throughout Europe, Australia, we have in the United States, of course, across Canada, we have lots of information about different kinds of interventions, the percentages of population estimates that are impacted by a hoarding problem. They range from about 2 to 5%. There was a recent meta-analysis done that showed about 2.5%, again, in the global north, of a population suffers with a hoarding problem. So we know it's a significant problem in those areas. And we have, you know, we have colleagues who are working on research. We have colleagues who are working on interventions. We have colleagues who are designing assessment tools. So we know lots is going on around the world.
Yeah, I would be curious on whether there's any change in the prevalence of hoarding disorder in maybe more developing countries.
So are we. We're very interested in that. And the truth is, we just don't know. You know, one of the things that's sometimes forgotten about hoarding is that this is a problem that we've really only been systematically studying for about 30 years' time, which means that our knowledge is still, we're really neophytes in our understanding of the causes of this problem, of the best ways to assess and intervene. We've learned quite a lot from our research. It's research is emerging all the time, every day, so it makes it a very exciting field to be a part of, but there's still quite a lot we don't know. When you compare hoarding disorder as a mental health condition to a problem like schizophrenia or psychosis as a mental health problem, we've been studying those for 200 and 300 years of time. And so there's much more knowledge there across the board than what we have for hoarding. So stay tuned, I guess, is the answer. We'll know more in the coming days and years.
Yeah, does that mean that maybe hoarding disorders may be more of a modern problem? Is this something that maybe we've observed happen historically, or is it something rather new?
It actually, there are references to it in lots of early literature. So, for example, Dante's Inferno, which is a very early piece of literature, refers to a level of hell where there are too many things. So you see the characterization of this problem. Early psychiatric literature in the early 1800s refers to this problem as collector's mania. So they thought it a form of mania. So no, this is not a new problem, but what is new is the attention that we're paying to it and the scientific study of it.
Do you think that this newfound attention hoarding disorder maybe would decrease the severity of it in the long run in the future?
You know, I think what's going to help us reduce the severity of the problem is earlier intervention. And we're quite a way away from prevention of this problem in that the research just isn't there yet to help us understand some of the genetic markers for this problem or some of the trait features. And again, we have some clues about all of that right now, but we just don't know enough to be at prevention. I think earlier intervention is something that is achievable sooner rather than later. And that will, if we can get people to identify the problem through proper assessment and begin to intervene sooner rather than later, then we can avoid some of the severity of the problem. And what I mean by that is that we know that hoarding has a chronic and worsening course, which means that it does not get better on its own. And in fact, it's only going to get worse until the point of intervention. So, I guess for everyone who's listening, one of the takeaways here is if you know someone who is collecting and saving lots of things in their home to the point where there is interference and you're worried about their well-being, their health, or their safety, then actually doing something sooner, not turning a blind eye, not saying, oh, you know, we'll see what happens in the next 3 months or 6 months. We actually know what will happen. So earlier intervention is a better way to go.
Right. So would you say maybe the earliest point of intervention would be when you really start to see issues moving around the house? I struggle to see where maybe there's someone who's like maybe just a bit of a messier person. They don't have a hoarding disorder. How do you know where the early intervention is the best place to start?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So the first thing that I always recommend is have a conversation with the person, kind of express how what you've noticed in the environment. If you have a concern for their health and safety, do this without judgment using I statements. So expressing, I'm concerned for you. It seems like you can't sleep in your bed anymore because there's too much stuff piled up there. Or I'm worried that you couldn't get out of that window if you needed to, if there was a fire or some other emergency in your house. So you hear that the responsibility rests with the person making the comment, and there's not a finger pointing saying you. And then as you have that conversation, I think it's really important to listen, not just to speak. And what you're listening for is, do you hear the person expressing strong, meaningful attachment to the objects? That is, these items can be used in the future. I can't get rid of these things because they're related to my profession or my hobby or my education. And alongside the many, many reasons that the person might give you for having a strong attachment, are they also expressing strong emotions, which is that phrases like, I would die if I had to give this away, or I just know something bad is going to happen if I don't keep this. Those kind of emotional expressions can be a clue. And again, this isn't definitive, but can be a clue that we're talking about somebody who has potentially cross the line from being a person who lives in a messier environment, maybe who just didn't learn some of the same housekeeping skills as other people, who is a collector or a hobbyist that has too many things from someone who actually has strong attachment to possessions and is therefore unable to let them go, characteristics that we see in hoarding behavior.
At the start of the podcast, you mentioned that hoarding disorder really became prevalent in the public eye with the help of TV shows. And I know that, like, the first time I heard of hoarding disorder was watching Hoarders as a kid. I was just wondering if you had any personal opinions on how the show handled portraying people with hoarding disorder.
Yes, I think, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag because television and all media brings to attention social problems and they bring the discourse forward. So people are now talking about hoarding. We have language for this. When I was very first a young social worker working on the streets years and years ago, I knew I saw hoarding in people's home, but I didn't have language for that. I didn't know what it was called. I certainly didn't know how to assess or intervene. But now we have language and we have images in our mind and we have this concept and we know that it is both a personal problem and a public problem. And so in that way, raising hoarding to social awareness and social problem status has been very helpful. On the other hand, the television shows may perpetuate stigmatization around this problem and internalized shame on the part of the person. We know that the television shows often depict cases of hoarding that are both severe in terms of the quantity of objects in the home, as well as portraying squalor or filth. And one of the unfortunate things is those two things do sometimes go together, but not always. And so we have now a little confusion between filth and too many things in the home. And what one of the other unfortunate things, especially for people who are suffering from hoarding and their family members, anyone who's distressed by the problem, is that the television shows often portray a rather speedy intervention. So two guys in a truck in a weekend and the problem's kind of taken care of. But of course, we know that this is a mental health problem with lots of complicated co-occurring social and other mental health problems alongside it. And so the interventions are complicated. They take time. And sometimes when people with lived experience of hoarding see this, or a family that's desperate to help their loved one sees this, they think, well, why can't we get this cleaned up? What's wrong with me or with my loved one that we can't get this done in a weekend's time? So it sets up an unrealistic picture of the problem itself and an unrealistic view of appropriate interventions.
Yeah, to add on to that, I always found it a bit unsettling how TV would just exploit a person's psychological disorder for entertainment.
Yes, and I have to say, you know, some of the television shows did offer people who appeared on the show mental health treatment as well outside of appearing on the show. And for some people who live in rural environments or who don't have access to trained clinicians in their area, the shows actually provided a way in for them to have some help around the problem. But your point is well made about sensationalized television and the personal and social impact that that has.
Yeah, and moving on into the future, is there a way TV shows could more responsibly portray a hoarding disorder?
I think one thing is to make clear the concepts to really differentiate hoarding from squalor or filth, to show that the problem occurs from mild to life-taking, although those mild cases are far less suitable for making good television, and also showing appropriate interventions, again, which aren't necessarily made for television, hard work that occurs with a therapist or with some supports in your home over a longer period of time is really what's required here. But again, I'm not sure that that's the stuff of television. So we may always be at a bit of a crossroads.
Yeah. That was the last question I had for you. It was a pleasure having you on the show. You're welcome back anytime. It was definitely an interesting conversation to have. I definitely learned a lot.
Great. Thank you very much. And if anyone's listening and they are personally impacted by this problem or their family is, I would encourage you to visit the UBC Center for Collaborative Research on Hoarding. We have a website and we have a number of resources and information about our research posted there. Thank you again for the invitation. It's been quite fun to talk with you.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, and that was our interview with Dr. Christiana Bratiotis. We hope you join us again 2 weeks from now on Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM to listen to another episode of Research Review.